Hello, everybody. I'm Jacopo Dettoni, and this is the FDI podcast. The Prime Minister of Thailand, General Prayut Chan-o-cha, has just wrapped up his first visit to the UK and France since he's in power in 2014. He met with Theresa May in London and Emmanuel Macron in Paris to give reassurances over a long-delayed transition back to democracy, with elections now announced for February 2019, and promote the Thailand 4.0 vision, the vision that the government has designed to give new impetus to the Thai economy. Should we expect General Prayut to deliver on his promises and ambitious economic plans, and what this all means for international investors? I'm here in our studio in London with Dr. Lee Jones, a reader in international politics at the Queen Mary University of London. Lee, after the meeting with Theresa May and General Prayut, Downing Street put out a note urging, and I quote here, continued progress towards free and open elections in Thailand in line with international standards. So how realistic are, in your view, these expectations for elections in February 2019?
Well, just after the visit, another senior Thai official said that the elections could be postponed until May.
Again.
And this is just the latest in a long line of broken promises and postponements. And even if the elections happened, the idea that they would be in line with international standards, I think, is dubious. It depends what you mean by international standards. But the constitution that the military regime has imposed on the country is deliberately designed to be undemocratic, to boost minority parties and prevent the return to power of parties aligned to Thaksin Shinawat, the Thai prime minister who was overthrown by the military in the other coup in 2006. So the system is being rigged, but they're not very good at rigging it, and that's why they keep delaying the return of democracy.
Right. They also mentioned that now, but very recently, they also mentioned that they want the coronation of the Prince Vajiralongkorn to happen before elections. And some analysts also read this as another pretext, in a way, for another reason or pretext for them to create room for another delay.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons for the delays has been the death of King Bhumibol, the long-running Thai monarch whose illness and the succession question has been burning along in the background of Thai politics for a long time, because the current king's father was widely popular and he was seen as a stabilising force, although I think it's actually pretty dubious. I think he actually plays a fairly limited role in politics, mainly to justify and be the rubber stamp of military coups in practice. And his son was widely unpopular and deeply disliked. And so there was this crisis about the succession. Now he is on the throne, but not formally crowned. But he spends most of his time in Germany, not in Thailand. So, you know, arranging the coronation is not necessarily straightforward, as it may seem.
Right. Let's see. Let's hear what Minister Uttama Sanawayana, who is the Minister of Industry of Thailand, told me last week in London. He is a cabinet minister and he was part of the delegation that visited London last week. And I asked him about this very topic, about the elections, and this is what he answered me.
When Prime Minister Prayut met with the Prime Minister of UK, Theresa May, yesterday, he assured her that we have a roadmap towards election, which should be in February next year. So I think that has shown the commitment. So it has given a very good foundation for both sides agree to enhance further our cooperation in many fields.
And this is an important point. I mean, the fact that the Prime Minister visited at least the UK and France for the first time since being in power, I think is and kind of creating the room for being in a way accountable. He is telling his counterparts in Europe that there will be election. Whether or not they will happen in 2019 in February, it's another issue. But at least it's creating some room for accountability, and this is a major issue because since the coup. For example, there were free trade. There were negotiations for a free trade agreement between the UK and Thailand that got suspended. Now, apparently, they sort of started talks with the UK government for a free trade agreement in a post-Brexit scenario. But anyway, there is a whole kind of international diplomacy between diplomatic negotiations between the European bloc and Thailand since the coup basically hung there in the balance. So in a way, I guess this was one of the main issues of his talks in Paris and London last week.
Yeah, I mean, the EU has not really known what to do about Thailand since the 2014 coup. They're not very happy that there is a military regime, but the regime from the very beginning has been committed to the restoration of democracy, as military regimes often are. And so what do you do in that situation? Do you impose sanctions? Do you try to coerce them? What realistically can you do? There's very limited leverage of the Western powers. And the United States has been very worried about pushing Thailand into the arms of China as well. The visit is an interesting one. You know, what was he up to? Why is he suddenly kind of touring European countries? I think it may be part of him positioning himself for a career as a quote-unquote civilian politician. There are question marks about his political future. Is he going to run for office under the restored democracy, quote-unquote? He's been very coy about his future. I think he's dithering about, you know, whether he would really have the popular support. Lots of fake polls get published saying how happy Thais are with General Prayut and how they'd like him to stay in power. But I think quite a lot of Thais would like to get rid of him as well. So this constant dithering about whether the military is going to kind of organise a new political party that he would head and he could become the new elected prime minister, and whether that would be acceptable to enough Thais to make that work, whether that would be acceptable to Thailand's foreign partners. I think they're not very good at it, basically rigging the system, and so they're kind of feeling around to see if something like this would work. That's my guess about what that visit was fundamentally about.
And obviously, I mean, one of the reasons why we are discussing all this is that Thailand remains a major destination for a major, like, fast developing economy in the region and a major recipient of foreign investment. But since the coup, things also, from their perspective, sort of slowed down. The economy is not really running as fast as it used to be 10, 15, 20 years ago. And also from a foreign investment perspective, I was just like going through the figures this morning. Right, 2013, the year before the coup, was the record year for foreign investment, and then the inbound investment flows kind of plummeted over the past 3 years. So, what does all mean? The restoration of democracy, or anyway, the future of the military junta matters also from a business economic perspective. And I spoke to Simon Scheel, who is the CEO of a senior aviation, who is an engineering company based in the UK, but with a branch in Thailand dealing with aviation. And I asked him about the business environment under the military junta, and this is what he answered me.
Since I've been there, I've been through two military coups, been doing things. And the thing about Thailand is business carries on. There's a number of rich families in Thailand that need business to carry on. They're all in this Bangkok centre, okay, which is the Zen discussions about how do we benefit and pull guys from the north, train them, teach them, because the Thais don't necessarily do that themselves. Okay, so from my point of view, these guys have laid some legal changes which are actually going to make it more difficult for anyone to change those laws. It's not democracy as we know it, and you don't expect it. You know, is democracy the right answer? That's a massive debate in its own right. Okay, in Asia, this works for Thailand. And they always respect business because it's never even been hassled by any coup or any disruption to government. So for me, what they've laid down is a pathway that's positive for Southeast Asia and Thailand, which in their mind they want to be the centre and the hub. There's no reason why it can't be, but they can't do it without foreign money.
So he definitely touches upon a couple of interesting points. So what his perception is that, anyway, there is business continuity, there is still a business environment which is conducive to for businesses and domestic and foreign businesses. But he also kind of highlights the fact that they need foreign capital, and sort of assuming that what I was saying before, that actually in the past few years, foreign investment has slowed down significantly.
Yeah, I mean, his remarks are interesting. It shows really the very limited respect that a lot of capitalists have for democracy, of course. And it's not really true, as you've just intimated, that coups are no problem for business. I mean, foreign investment, as you say, is way down. And if you look at the 2006 coup, economic growth falls. And then, of course, you've got the impact of the global financial crisis. There's a big crackdown in Bangkok in 2010, and that leads to economic growth rates basically halving in the space of a year. And then after the 2014 military coup, the economy has sort of stumbled along at very low growth rates relative to the region overall. One of the things that has really impacted, and this relates to the Thailand 4.0 and the Eastern Economic Corridor stuff, is the previous democratically elected government had approved a deal with China for a massive high-speed railway link, nearly 900 kilometres long. And that's really been taken off the table by the military regime, and they've only approved a section that's 3.5 kilometres long, partly because of concerns about corruption, partly because the military regime's not that interested, because it can't profit itself from those kinds of infrastructure investments, whereas the purchasing of boondoggle kind of white elephants like submarines, for example, that's been fast-tracked, the importation of new armaments from China and so on. So it's not quite right to say that business isn't affected by coups. Who's in power, given the nature of state power in Thailand, in Southeast Asia more generally? Who's in power does matter. But the business environment in Thailand generally is more robust than it might be elsewhere, where you have a military coup and you then get very, very sharp turndowns or business uncertainty. But I think this very prolonged transition where the regime keeps saying, oh, we're going to restore democracy, don't worry, you know, we're bringing stability back, and then nothing happens, it will cause investors to delay investment, right, because of the policy uncertainty.
And I guess also like the continuity of some of the things that are the policies they are trying to implement remains a question mark. You know?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things they're trying to do essentially is, with the new constitution and various basic laws, is entrench their economic plans as a form of kind of quasi-constitution so that it couldn't be amended by subsequent populist governments. So they're trying to give that stability and certainty. But the big question mark is, when the military finally step back from power and restore democracy, is all the institutional tinkering that they've been doing going to be enough to prevent the return of the clash between the red shirts and the yellow shirts that have affected Thai politics for the last 10, 15 years? And I think that's really open to question. I don't think that a few institutional tweaks is enough to eradicate the very deeply rooted social and political conflicts.
And actually, one of the main pillars of the government economic development vision is the so-called Eastern Economic, well, Thailand 4.0, and as part of Thailand 4.0, the so-called Eastern Economic Corridor, which is basically they want to build up on the success of the Eastern Seaboard Initiative of the 90s, which actually fostered and triggered a lot of industrial development in Eastern provinces in the region. And they want to build up on this success, so turn those industrialized provinces, bring them a step forward to from traditional manufacturing to advanced manufacturing. And when I was in Bangkok a month ago, I met with the secretary of the Eastern Economic Corridor office, which actually they had a law, as you were saying, a law that in a way crystallized the initiative as in a very clear legal framework. They established an Eastern Economic Corridor office, and this is Mr. Kanit Sangsuban, who is the secretary of the EEC initiative, and this is what he told me in Bangkok last month.
Thailand 4.0 is nothing than the visions for the country. Why we have to do that? Because of the lag behind technologies of the Thai in the past 10 years, right? The prime minister and the teams of the prime minister say, okay, how can we drive the economy? How can we drive the country into the future? The key words come up is the technology and human resources. That's two words. Technology, you need to capture technology to create the value creation for technology. in order to change the new way of living in the Thai people. EEC is a part of make Thailand profile or into reality. Get some area that we can work as a tangible result that can get the technology and get the target industry down to the earth, down to what we can be practical solution to the people. And that's the EEC come from.
So in a way, they two things here again. The government wants to find new engines of growth. It's clear that the economy is still, it's still growing at 4%, which for European standards, it's a very fast pace of growth. But obviously for Southeast Asian standards, this is pretty slow compared to neighboring countries or countries in the region, Vietnam, the Myanmar, etc. And also they want to do so through the Eastern Economic Corridor, where there is an infrastructure component and there is an innovation component through those 10 mentioned targeted industries like advanced materials, electronics, and so on, so robotics and others. Actually, I was there. This is a vision that has been in the air for a few years now, but actually the law was approved just earlier this year. I was in the area. In late May, and there is no actually tangible upcoming development yet. So basically, one of the key projects there is to make this airport at Utapao, which is close to Pattaya, a major international hub, and then connect this airport to the two airports in Bangkok through a high-speed railway. And again, there is no sign of development, neither the airport nor the railway. But they started the bidding process. They want to develop all this through PPPs, so through the involvement and engagement of foreign investors. And again, here the process is kicking off, is moving forward. You say it's moving its four steps. What is your feeling about its real feasibility?
Well, the Thais are confronting the same issue that a lot of the Southeast Asian economies are, which is how do you escape the middle income trap? So they've had very rapid industrial development from the 1980s onwards. And now the question is, can you move from heavy industry to a higher value-added form of production? And one of the ways they're thinking of doing it is building infrastructure, and this links to China's Belt and Road Initiative as well. And I think that the incentives that they've laid, if you look at the details, they're quite heavy incentives for foreign investors to come in. And so as long as there are no political controversies, as there was, for example, around the Chinese high-speed railway, there's a lot of controversy there about the rate of the loans that they would use to finance it. And eventually they say, well, we'll finance it ourselves. They just don't have enough capital to mobilize. So they have to be willing to either borrow to invest, which very few governments are willing to do these days, or accept quite a large role for foreign capital. And they've been a bit leery of doing that. So that's one big question mark. And then the second thing is, beyond foreign investment, that kind of industrial upgrading rests on soft infrastructure as well, particularly education, skills development. And this is an area where Thailand is pretty atrocious, actually. If you look at UNESCO figures, at high school level, people are finishing high school and about half of the population does not meet kind of minimum standards with respect to reading and mathematics, for example. And then skills development at the university level is also very poor. And that reflects a university system and education system more broadly that is intensely hierarchical, that is more interested in breeding social discipline into young people and in reinforcing social hierarchies than it is, for example, in developing critical thinking skills or enabling people to think for themselves. And that's what you need for a knowledge economy.
Definitely. That's a very interesting point. Actually, when I was there at the business reception following the visit of Prime Minister General Prayut, I met with a few representatives of British universities, particularly from University in Manchester and one in Liverpool, that actually are in talks with their counterparts in Thai universities to develop research programs, but not just research, just graduate programs, and upgrade the quality that students can get through these programs. And definitely this is a necessary step if they really want to become a country fertile for innovation, to even being in a position to develop their own technology. They definitely have to have the human resources in place, and so this necessarily leads to an upgrade of the existing education system.
And it's not just a technical question of upgrading, you know, so you just make some policy tweaks or something. It's fundamentally, it's a social and political question. You know, what kind of citizens are you trying to produce through your education system? And the answer persistently in Thailand has been obedient citizens who kowtow to their social betters. You know, university students having to wear uniforms and being forced to kowtow to images of Thailand's former kings and so on, and being beaten by the university lecturers when they refused to do it. I mean, that's the image of Thai education. It's an accurate one. And we're talking here about the country's elite institutions. When I teach Thai graduate students who come over here, they're from the country's best institutions. They really want to learn, they really want to succeed, but they find the British education system very, very challenging, because we expect students to challenge us, to critique us, to take on ideas, to argue, and to develop original ideas of their own. And they have not been prepared for that at any stage of their education. And coming here to do a master's degree in a single year, they can't develop those skills overnight. So what's needed is a really fundamental root and branch reform of the education system, but more broadly of the system of social hierarchy in Thailand that constrains education. That's going to be a real stumbling block for Thailand 4.0. And the final issue is about domestic consumption. Domestic consumption growth remains very sluggish in Thailand, and that's going to be a key component of some of these industries. Until that changes, it's difficult to see how Thailand 4.0 can succeed beyond the export economy. And that's fundamentally linked to wealth inequality in the country, which again links back to the wider social and political question.
Right. Let's see. Let's also see what, obviously, there are already foreign companies doing some advanced manufacturing in the country. The country has become, over the past decades, for example, a major center for the automotive industry, which tends to be one of the industries that are leading the innovation across the board for different reasons, for the different components and technology that a single car requires, in materials, in electronics, and so on and so forth. I spoke to Ray Gibbs, who is the CEO of Haydel, which is a British company that deals with advanced materials. And I found his remarks interesting, because beyond the internal domestic challenges of Thailand itself, he puts the country within a regional context. Mm. And from the perspective of an investor that has to decide where to locate his investment. So this is what he told me.
I looked at other countries. I felt that Thai was more stable than some others. You've heard about the Board of Investment. I think they were the approach that they've made was right. They are open for business. Others are there, but I think the Thais are far more sophisticated than others around at the moment. Other peripheral countries will catch up, but right now for us, Thailand was the right thing to do. The matter is that it's a great base. The infrastructure is there. There's also a lot of inbound investment in the automotive sector. Aerospace is coming in. Both of those are going to use advanced materials. They already do in part. And so it's an obvious place to be. We have a business that makes... We have a business that produces biomedical sensor strips for diabetes testing. And that we use a graphene ink, which gives a fantastic first layer adhesion and stability and quality of result. If you speak to a diabetes person, some of the products that are in the marketplace today don't test well. They get false readings or misreads, and it can be a problem. This is the product that we're producing now, which is actually first class. And that's all come out of Thailand and into Taiwan.
So in a way, he highlights the fact that, yeah, again, Thailand vis-a-vis to other countries probably is referring to countries like Vietnam or Myanmar, not even to mention Cambodia or Laos. Obviously, this Thailand is definitely a better location for companies like Haydel that deal with some more sophisticated manufacturing than textile, than the usual labor-intensive manufacturing that you would find in Vietnam. And this goes beyond probably political uncertainties, and if you probably this is kind of a typical foreign investor longer view that if you look at the long run picture, so it would make sense for them to locate there as opposed to be somewhere else in the region.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are political trends and froth on the surface, but then there's an underlying material reality that changes much more slowly. And if we think about the automotive sector, Thailand has become a major production platform for automobiles, serving the entire East Asian region. So it becomes a place where parts are put together, assembled into automobiles, and then exported. Often trucks and motorbikes in particular, and exported to China and the rest of the East Asian region. Now, what's interesting about that is it's an incredible success story in one way, but it also shows the perils for developing countries of adopting the export-oriented industrialization strategies, which is only being compounded by Thailand 4.0 and the plans there, which is most of the companies doing this are American, Japanese and European. They're not Thai companies. They're foreign automobile manufacturers. The parts in some cases are locally produced, but in other cases the components are being imported too. And so what's being done in Thailand is the assembly. And increasingly the local parts suppliers have also been vertically integrated into production chains. So the Japanese in particular have bought up a lot of local component producers and integrated them into their production facilities. So what happens is the value is all being captured by these foreign companies. The value being added is relatively small in Thailand. It's, you know, people physically operating machinery and sticking these parts together, and then they're exported again. So it's fantastic for foreign capital, not so great for the local economy, and that's where you get stuck in that middle income trap.
Well, that's exactly the point that I also made to the Board of Investment when I met them, and the same Eastern Economic Corridor office. And actually, they definitely, I mean, at least on paper, part of the new incentives are also engineered to strengthen link-ups with between the foreign capital and the foreign companies and local suppliers, local universities, private and public research centers. But obviously, this is definitely something that you always have to consider when you're assessing the value that a foreign investment can generate. And it's an ongoing debate in the industry. How much value can we generate through? Can we leverage? Can we generate through foreign investment? How can we strengthen and increase the links between the foreign companies that had the technology but not necessarily are always willing to transfer their own technology, and local companies, local institution, and so on and so forth. That's definitely it. Well, Lee, I would say just a very last question. So if we frame Thailand within a more regional perspective, how would you assess the state of institutions in Thailand? Where is the country heading? We are seeing, not just in the region, but all over the world, that there is a sort of there are these strong leaders popping up everywhere. I mean, we are seeing, like, for example, in the region, the Philippines, always through a democratic process, but Rodrigo Duterte being that strong, sort of a Trump, Trump before Trump, because he was even elected before Donald Trump. But then you see Europe, President Erdogan in Turkey remaining just being just gaining a new re-election, President Prime Minister Orban in Hungary. So this the emergence of this the rise of these strong leaders that seem to be kind of marking a new political phase where that business comes first, but definitely where there is some consensus over the fact that a strong leader may not necessarily be worse than a democratic elected leader. And this, in a way, Singapore has always been a major example for this. In Singapore, incredibly successful economic story, not necessarily perfect democracy, but this is a country that many other countries around the world have taken as an example for the development of their institutions and economies. So what is the future? What do you see in the future of Thailand in terms of its institutions?
So, I mean, I think populism is on the rise everywhere. And it's on the rise because of common social and economic trends, particularly the decline of the national developmental state and in the West social democracy. So we're seeing, you know, rampant inequality all around the world, which is not accidental. It's the result of a particular way of governing the economy. And people are reacting to that in different ways. People who are being excluded or marginalized, left behind by globalization, are looking to populists to solve their problems. But equally, centrists, the middle classes, also look to strong men to sort out their problems, to simplify things, to make things easier, to make sure that so-called good people are in charge of things. So, I mean, Thailand, you've seen the clash of two different sorts of populisms in a way. The populism of Thaksin Shinawat, who represented a very strange alliance between big business people and ordinary working Thais, particularly in the northeast, but also in Bangkok, who, you know, fused those two agendas together, a big business agenda, but one that was also pro-poor for the first time, really, ever. He actually kept his promises to the poor for around healthcare and village-level development and so on. And what we see now with Prayut is a sort of centrist populism. Some people looking for a strong leader to come in and cut away all the complexity, all the social conflicts, all the class conflicts that arise out of societal development and economic development, and just make sure that the right policies are in place, that the technocrats can run the economy and they don't have to pay any attention to the stupid voters, as they call them. They call them buffaloes. The middle classes call the lower classes buffaloes in Thailand. In the same way that people sneer at Trump voters or Brexit voters in the West, it's a similar sort of dynamic. So the hollowing out of representative democracy, the hollowing out of national development with globalization, I think, is giving rise to these contending forms of populism, not just in Thailand, but in the rest of the world. And I don't think that's going to go away, because there are structural drivers to this. So imagine that when democracy eventually is restored in Thailand, we will basically see two different camps, a kind of neoliberal, technocratic, centrist, middle-class-based populism versus a populism that fuses together the concerns of certain big business elites with ordinary working Thais.
Do you expect General Prayut to run again for president in civilian
Quite possibly. I mean, he does seem to be positioning himself, and he would be the populist candidate in that first camp. Yeah. Whereas there's another kind of leading Thai businessman who's sort of positioning himself to be the populist candidate in the second camp. So the battle lines are already being drawn, but, you know, who knows when we will actually see elections in Thailand.
Perfect. Lee Jones, reader of International Politics at the Queen Mary University of London. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks, everybody, for listening. You can find
all our podcasts on our website, fdiintelligence.com/podcast, or on Acast and iTunes. Stay tuned, and until the next time.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Join Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin for a new edition of the Capital Ideas Podcast. In unscripted conversations with investment professionals, you'll hear real stories about successes and lessons learned, informed by decades of investment experience. It's your look inside one of the world's largest asset managers. New episodes are available monthly. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Invest 30 minutes in an episode today. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.